Okay, if you can read the bottom of the slide there, this is our 10th class on Deuteronomy. We're going to be taking up chapters 22 and 23 here this evening. And just exactly like last week, where we really entered into a block of the book that is giving us what we might just call sundry laws, I've decided tonight that I'm not even going to try and produce an outline for you like I've done the last couple of weeks. Even in the last couple of weeks, you know, we'd have six or eight things in a given chapter to be listing. It's far more than that. It's twice that in these chapters. And so I'll certainly designate for you the individual verses. And if you want to make brackets, then great. But I think the longest passage that we have has only got about 10 verses, and quite a few that only have one or two or three, that sort of thing. Secondly, I would say as we get rolling here that in a list like this where clearly these things are not connected, some of the commentators have suggested, and I'd readily admit that this is just, you know, an idea that they have had. It's not like we can turn somewhere to read what I'm about to say. But it appears, I think I would subscribe to their theory, that God is not intending here to list absolutely every law that was known to the Jews, that he may have revealed in years gone by, or had revealed or been taught by Moses in the last 40 years. Certainly, the laws that we are getting are not the comprehensive, so that you could say there is not another law. They are so widely variant as well that they don't seem to be grouped by any particular topic that we can identify. And so perhaps God is just singling out individual types of laws to make a point about the types of people that they are to be. But as you'll see, now, for instance, we'll have one shortly here about making sure you have a handrail around the top of your house, since they built flat-roofed houses and lived so much of their time on the roof. So, well, you don't want to fall off the roof, so you have to have, you know, a handrail, a parapet of some kind to prevent people from falling off. Well, is that to say that that is the only civil law with regard to safety? Well, hardly, you know, and so it indicates that you have to be careful to protect people from themselves, from accidents, and that sort of thing. But it's not to say that then you could go out and just be wild and reckless and crazy all the rest of the time. It is perhaps just emblematic that you're supposed to be looking out for other people. I don't know if you saw this one this last couple of days. It's been on the news now for a couple of days, but I think it was Yellowstone Park, and we get these stories, you know, just constantly. And so here's that ever-present gaggle of people standing around the bison taking pictures. Is there anybody in America who hasn't heard 47 times that you're not supposed to get out of your car, you're not supposed to interact with the animals, it's dangerous? So now the last 2 days, we've got this fabulously distressing video of a 9-year-old girl who must have been hurled about 7 or 8 feet in the air and maybe 20 feet out, you know, ahead of this bison. And apparently she's relatively uninjured. They took her back to the medical facility. She went home that night, you know, with her parents and all of that. But how easily she could have been killed, and how stupid it is, you know, that they're doing this thing. Signs everywhere, you know, America's Funniest Home Video showing you this. How can you not know this? And sure enough, the thing just charged. The adults went one way, the girl went the other. The beast, you know, picks her out. Well, brethren, you're supposed to be safe. And you're supposed to love your family. You're supposed to love your fellow Jews. You're supposed to love everybody on the planet. And so I think we just need to be careful not to think in terms that we can count the number of laws and now we know the totality of what God expected out of the Jews. I rather suspect there are a lot more laws that had been only revealed orally, had not been written down in the literature. But God had a very thorough and comprehensive law. And so not just if you commit murder, here's what you do, you know, or you're a kidnapper, but a wide-ranging set of laws. And the third thing that I think I'd like to point out, too, is that we're going to see, especially tonight, and some of these we've seen already in Leviticus, that some of these laws are just really incomprehensible. The commentators and Bible students for millenniums have never been able to figure out the reason why for some of these. So we'll get to them in just a moment. They seem kind of outlandish. They seem kind of silly. They don't seem to have any root in safety, any root in morality. They just, you know, it's just hard to figure out, well, what was that about? And so I would just add to our little introductory discussion right here as we're looking at these very different kinds of laws, that some of these laws, I believe, as we will, as we saw at length rather in Leviticus with the dietary laws, are really, remember I used the word arbitrary, but I don't mean it, you know, in any kind of a derogatory manner. God is a sovereign God who can make a law of any kind that he wants. But on a number of occasions, we will find God specifically saying, I made thus and such a law to test you, to see whether you would be faithful. Not because there was some deep underlying cosmic verity that God is revealing to us, beyond the fact that he would establish a law later to be done away, so clearly not of any moral nature. This is a law that can come or go. But God setting standards for the Jews just because they're his people, for the purpose of singling them out. They would be readily recognizable by everybody else as a different and unique and separate kind of a people. And then the fourth thing that I'd say here is that some of these might have to do with circumstances, either socially or more likely with regard to religious practices among the idolaters that now quite literally make no sense to us, because we don't know any idolaters who did these particular things. So if they're told not to cut themselves or apply tattoos or shorten, you know, the sideburns, these may be things that, while they are seemingly just very arbitrary and incomprehensible, may be rooted in societal conditions of the time. So now that's lost to us. It's not elaborated upon in the law itself. Would have been known to those people. It's vanished, you know, into the mists of time for us. So frequently, these are the things that the unbeliever wants to make mockery of. These are the things that they want to bore in and attack. See how silly, how ridiculous, how incomprehensible that these things are. Well, if you have already made up your mind that they are these things and that you are the infallible arbiter of why these laws exist, if you got those two ideas rattling around in your head, well, then maybe there's room to mock God's laws. When you don't know why God gave a law, then it's a good idea to respect the superior wisdom of your God and trust that there were very sound and just reasons why these things were said, whether or not I can understand it. Most everybody here has been a child. Raise your hand if you were a baby. So you've been subject to the laws of your parents. Most of you, many of you at least, have raised children, have had kids in the house. How many times do the kids understand why you give them the law? How many times have you looked down and said, here's the law, and someday you'll understand why? You know, I don't deem you to be old enough, wise enough, capable enough, you know, to have the why right now. I'm just asking you to trust me. This is the why, or this is the law. Trust me that I have a reasonable why. So we'll see a bunch of these all here tonight. But it's not fodder for mockery. It is, in faith, the wisdom of God that may elude us today and still remains the sovereign wisdom of God. Now, the first one in chapter 22 does have a little bit of a block at least. We got four verses, so not quite the longest one in these two chapters, but pushing it. And so the first four verses, I just entitled Lost Animals. But surely, brethren, this must be a representative law. This would then lead one to understand the attitude with this case. but I think is intended, as I've just been saying in the introduction, to teach us about attitudes so that we can apply the principle here to other cases. So, you shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. And if your countryman is not near you, or if you don't know him, then you shall bring it home to your house. It shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it. Then you shall restore it to him. Well, brother, now you're feeding it, you're protecting it, you're cleaning up after it. But, that, you know, no matter. It's an expense to you now. But this is your countryman's, you know, sheep or goat or cow or whatever it is. And it represents value to them. It's to be respected. Then it says, verse 3, and thus you shall do with his donkey. You shall do the same with his garment. You shall do likewise with anything lost by your countrymen, which he's lost and you found. You're not allowed to neglect them. You shall not see your countryman's donkey or his ox fallen down on the way and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly help him to raise it up. And by the way, Jesus would add kind of an inspired commentary to all of this. Would this include the Sabbath day? Jesus makes the point, it certainly includes the Sabbath day as well. So perfectly legal to do a terrible lot of hard work in rescuing and caring for these animals, even if they're not your own, and even on a Sabbath day, because this is the kind of person you're supposed to be. Anything that you find that's lost. Don and I taught our kids, and we had several times where it was just kind of comical and a little bit fun, you know, don't mean to torture them and everything. But, you know, kids are endlessly curious. And so, well, we were often taking them out for just a walk, you know, a walk along the side of the road. And some, you know, little thing they'd spy. And a child just can't help themselves. What do? They run over and they pick it up. Okay. So I taught them at a very, very early age. You cannot litter. This will not be tolerated. If you pick it up, you own it. And then the other thing I taught them was, and if you go and you find a thing and you don't know who it belongs to, then one thing you know for sure, it doesn't belong to you. You don't know who it belongs to. You know you, then it doesn't belong to you. And this is effectively what the Lord is teaching right here. Now, you find these things, you don't just claim them. You find these things, you know they're not yours. You have to be responsible for them. You may not know who it belongs to. They may be from a far distance, but now you're going to have to take care of it. As soon as they come to claim it, it goes back to them. Now, the next one, and we've already seen in Leviticus, is a single verse 5. A woman shall not wear man's clothing, nor shall a man put on a woman's clothing. For whoever does these things is an abomination to Yahweh your God. Now, I had occasion with Leviticus. I had handed out a sheet that lists all the abominations. I've made the point on a couple of the sexual sins charts, the 33 sexual sins that we collected out of the book of Leviticus and some already out of the book of Deuteronomy as well here, that only 5 of the sexual sins, many of which are called an abomination and some of which carry a death penalty, are repeated in the New Testament. So it's my conviction that these lists of moral things, these things that have to do with sexuality and crossing the borders of sexuality, my title for this single verse is cross-dressing, these things, I believe, are just as much an abomination today before God as ever they were back then. Cross-dressing, to my knowledge, is not mentioned specifically in the New Testament. But I don't think it went away. God's loathing of this thing, or how wrong it is to do, just because it isn't specifically spelled out in the New Testament. Again, we have the ethic, we have the example, and so here's an abominable thing. It doesn't go away just because Christ became the Messiah, at least not in my view. And so, cross-dressing, in my view, every bit as evil as ever it was. Transvestism is a terrible thing. It's an abominable abomination in the sight of God. And as a matter of fact, as we've said so often, you can do by nature the things contained in the law was being explained by Paul to the Romans some 30 years, 25 years after Christ was raised from the dead. And I think, you know, these things are moral things. We understand, we have a certain sense of right and wrong that's built into us. And this is why we find it so disgusting to this day when you see people doing this. I'm never going to forget the first time that I walked into the medical clinic over here and saw a guy in a real tight, short, black dress putting on such a show you just can't imagine. And it was just very clear. This man is mentally ill. He's extremely sick. And as he comes in here, it's a parade. He was going out of his way to get absolutely everybody's attention as he teetered along in his 3-inch stilettos. And what is that about? It's about an abomination. It's about a twisting of wires. It's about sin. It's about immorality. And just because it isn't specifically mentioned in the New Testament, we still feel it. It's just so revolting. It is so disgusting. You just, every fiber of your body tenses up. And that's because you can do by nature the things that are contained in the law. So some of these things are spelled out, some of these are not. But every time, you know, you have that ick factor where you're just revolted and disgusted and just all you want to do is just turn away and, you know, and just be sick to your stomach. It is, I believe, a built-in inherent sense of morality that God bestows upon all of those who are not somehow mentally deranged. Now, the next one is one of these that the skeptics just absolutely love, and it's verses 6 and 7. If you happen to come upon a bird's nest along the way, in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go. But the young you may take for yourself, in order that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days. Brethren, based upon the promise that God offers for keeping it, the blessing that you accrue when you obey this law, then I think we can take it that there's something important that lies behind it. But do we know what it was? No. And so you pick up the commentators, you know, you read all through the books, and everybody has this speculation and that speculation. But God didn't tell us. So what is it? Is it the first, you know, environmentalist, you know, animal rights passage? Is it, you know, just to have an attitude? What is it? You know, and I don't know. I don't guess I know. A lot of people suggest that, you know, if they were making the law, they'd do it exactly backwards. Why the poor little babies, you know, why are you going to kill them and eat them, you know, and leave the mother? It should be the other way around, you know, take the adults. Brethren, again, I don't know. I could speculate, but what's that worth? It's no better than anybody else's, and God didn't say it, so I don't know. But for these Jews, and at this time, there is something here that, you know, we can learn from, but I'm not sure how, you know, specific or how far even to apply it. So that's the law for the Jews. And by the way, if you want to make the footnote, that will also be found in Exodus 23, verse 19. So add that to your notes in your margin there. You can let the mother go. I guess my speculation, you know, is, well, then she can produce more. And so don't kill the mother. That's the whole end of the line. You know, she may have who knows how many more birds if you just let her go. So satisfy your hunger if you need. But again, I just, you know, that's just my reasoning. God didn't say, so we don't know. The Jews weren't allowed to question it. This was their law. Here's the parapet one I was telling you about, single verse. And so I just, my margin, put parapet, put handrail, whatever you like. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring blood guilt on your house if anyone falls from it. Again, I realize it's always dangerous when you're reading between the lines a little bit, but there's no blood guilt, I don't believe, unless somebody dies. So somebody falls off your roof and breaks their arm. And we had somebody fall off our trampoline and broke their arm, neighbor kid. We had another neighbor kid who was being towed on his skateboard by a kid on a bicycle at the end of a long rope, turned the corner into our driveway too tight and wrapped up the trailer around our mailbox. So I recall that broke another arm. I once had an EMT come out to the property and said, "Why is it always you guys?" He said, "Well, we had boys, I guess." But, you got to have a thought for safety. So, does this mean that you can dig pits and not put up signs and conceal them or whatever? I think for the same reason. Whatever it would be that might be a stumbling block somehow and could lead to an accidental fatality, let alone an intentional one, then you have to take steps to prevent it. So to this day, as a matter of fact, our own building codes require these kinds of things. Now, the next one, again, is a single verse. "You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, lest all the produce of the seed which you have sown and the increase of the vineyard become defiled." Now, in this case, of course, we're all very tempted to run out, and start studying plant genetics, and that kind of thing, trying to figure out what was God saying about the nature of these plants and all. And again, I'm just not sure that that's the point of it at all. That word defiled, we've had occasion to discuss. Does a defilement necessarily mean that you've committed some moral crime like lying, stealing, raping, kidnapping, or murdering? No. And some of these defilements clearly go away when the law is done away. Very arbitrary then, in a not negative sense, laws that do not have some sort of permanent core in the nature of God or man. So why? I don't know. But the defilement here, the increase of is defiled, doesn't necessarily have to be from some sort of cross-pollination or something, I don't think. It may just be God saying, if you disobey my law, a defilement does take place when you disobey my law. He has repeatedly said he will curse you, your offspring, and your produce, and your cattle, and whatnot, if you disobey his law. And so the defilement may simply come because you violated the law, not because of something particularly inherent in the nature of what takes place here. See another one with garments in a minute. Carol.
Yeah. Would a defilement happen if somebody had taken a Nazirite vow and the grain had touched the grape leaves?
I'm not sure. Carol's brought up a really good point because, like the parapet, you don't want somebody to fall accidentally. And when people take some of these vows, you don't want to be in a position to accidentally, defile them, set them back. The Nazirite vow, you're going to start all over again. But I don't know a passage I could turn to and say you're right or you're wrong. It's a great thought. It's just unverifiable. Okay, so here yet is another of these single lines in verse 10. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not do that. Okay? So, for instance, one commentary I read just today, as a matter of fact, one I highly respect, says, well, the reason for this is because the ox is so much bigger than the donkey, it's dangerous and torturous for them to be yoked together. So this is about animal cruelty. Is that a fact that they tend to be terribly mismatched in size and power and gait and all the rest? Certainly so. An ox and a donkey are one's a lot smaller than the other. That's the fact is so. Is that the reason why God gave the law? Well, I don't know. Could you not build a yoke? Because you were poor and you only had two animals, couldn't you build a yoke that had a step down, for your donkey? Yeah, I guess you could. But are you allowed to? No, you're not allowed to. So, again, as Carol just suggested, it's a very reasonable idea to explain a reason behind the law. But does God tell us? No. So whether I can only imagine one reason or 100 reasons, I'm still left with not knowing. Just because I can only think of one reason doesn't make it right. It could be a dozen more that I just didn't think of yet. So again, they just needed to be in submission to the law. Did I see a hand up? There it is, Sabre.
Isn't there a scripture that says if we must submit to
the
law, must not unequally yoke things. People ought not to be unequally yoked, and neither are bound.
Thank you. See, and again, that's what you get is an expression now, 1 Corinthians 6, unequally yoked to a what? To an unbeliever. So now we're talking about marriage. Well, typically men are bigger than women. So it's about the cruelty to the smaller woman, right? No, you know, of course not. In this case, the unequally yoked hadn't got anything in the world to do with size. What's it about? It's about faith. It's about peace in the home. It's about, you know, your children. And he'll elaborate that in other places. You know, otherwise, they would be defiled, you know. And, you know, here they're sanctified. Now, but, you know, when I look at something like that, I see, obviously, you know, the connection. We're unequally yoked. But, again, they're totally different applications. And so, again, I'm at a loss. So tonight, you know, like you've heard me do so many times, the operative word is I don't know. Okay, I don't think that's necessarily bad. When God doesn't tell you, you can't know. So I wish I could answer those questions. I can't, and I can't answer the next one either, which encompasses 1 verse 11. You shall not wear a material mixed of wool and linen together. Now somebody please explain that one to me. And what does that tell us about nylon? I don't know. Okay, so yeah, we got a lot of these now. You know, we've looked at 4 of them here. Is that right? 4, yeah. 3. And so I wish I did. I wish God had explained, but he didn't. Does he have to? No. Does there even need to be anything lying behind the law greater than because I said so? No. Doesn't have to be anything greater than that. God is a sovereign king. So I don't get the wool and linen. And sure, I've read paragraph after paragraph, year after year, people explaining their ideas, why they think that is. And I just admit my ignorance. And then finally, 12, you shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of your garment with which you cover yourself. Well, here we go. You know, 4 corners, 4 points of the compass, 4 winds of heaven, and they run off, you know, with the number 4 and what it's supposed to mean, and, you know, and all the rest of that. Tassel means this, and off we go. Nothing is explained. Now, my guess is that God really wanted the Jews to stand out. We talked about it extensively in the Leviticus class. He wanted those Jews to be separate from everybody else. He wanted them to have an identity that was very distinct from everybody else. And if you have somewhat of a uniform, look, there go those people who won't mix wool, you know, and flax or whatever it was, I've already forgotten, wool and linen, and they, you know, also have the tassels. Now, to this day, and recently, I saw it right here in Oregon, you can be walking down the street and you will see people with the tassels. Well, I guess we were up in Washington, weren't we? Yeah, it was out by Mark's house. Dawn and I were out for a walk with the grandkids in Bellevue, and here was this whole group of people. It was Saturday. And immediately, you can just tell. You don't have to even see facial features or body types. You can just tell from the clothing. Where are they coming home from? Synagogue. Okay? Readily identifiable. So I'm guessing that this is why God said to do that. But what is the grand and great significance, brethren, between 4 and 7 tassels? Now, I'm told with no authority whatsoever, the commentators just say it. I've never been able, and I've read articles about how you can't find any rationale behind it. 7 means this as opposed to 10 that means that, and 3 stands for thus and such, and 6 is less than 7, so that's got to mean something. And all that numerology is never defined in Scripture. So when I look at a passage like this, I don't go laboring at great length to tell you what the grand significance of four is and why they had to have four tassels and couldn't have three, or couldn't have four or five or six or seven or whatever. I don't know. So I'm not going to speculate. Not going to speculate in numerology. Not going to speculate here. Now, we do have a long section that is in verses 13 through 20, 19 rather, 13 through 19, but actually continues, it's the longest one we're going to have, all the way down now to verse 21. Now, what these are a variety of sexual sins. Fornication is the one we usually use when we think of people who are not married, but that actually in both the Old Testament and the New is our word that means any and all forms of sexual impropriety. Then you have adultery stipulated in this passage, you have rape stipulated in this passage, and then you have sexual activity that may or may not have been a rape. And so now, if the person is innocent or if the person is guilty are going to be subsets of this passage. And what we're looking at is a variety of sexual sins in verses 13 through 21. It reads like this. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and then turns against her and charges her with shameful deeds and publicly defames her and says, I took this woman, but when I came near her, I did not find her a virgin. Then the girl's father and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of the girl's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. The girl's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man for a wife, but he turned against her, and behold, he's charged her with shameful deeds, saying, I did not find your daughter a virgin. But this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity. They shall spread the garment before the elders of the city. So the elders of that city shall take the man and chastise him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, give it to the girl's father, because he publicly defamed a virgin of Israel. She shall remain his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. Now again, I'm leaning heavily on the fact that we studied this in far more detail in the Sunday morning classes on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. So I'm not going to revisit that here. We already looked at this very passage, you know, in some detail in those studies. But verses 13 through 19 are if she's innocent. So this woman has been falsely charged with having been sexually active before she was married, and then lying about it. If she's innocent, the parents can prove it. You parents can explain this to your kids later. I'm not going to do it here. But there's a proof. And if it's submitted, she's innocent. Then it's going to cost this guy 8 years and 4 months' wages, is what most people suspect. So obviously, this is not a thing any guy's going to do very lightly. He's going to have to pay a fine of 8 years and 4 months' worth of wages, which would bankrupt and enslave most people, it seems, from what we know of the society. But she might be guilty. So in verse 20, if this charge is true, that the girl was not found a virgin, then they shall bring out the girl to the doorway of her father's house. Can you imagine how you're going to feel about that house when this is done? She's got to go back to her daddy's house, and in the doorway, the men of her city shall stone her to death because she's committed an act of folly in Israel by playing the harlot. Once again, here's our porneia, the word for fornication in the Septuagint version, which is the Hebrew translated into the Greek. That would be the standard of Jesus' day. And there it is again. So, she's committed an act of folly by playing the harlot in her father's house. Thus, you shall purge the evil from among you. So, sure enough, as I pointed out, you know, previously in the marriage divorce series, these parents have effectively become the witnesses either for or against. Every parent is going to be protecting their daughter, and they're going to be saving her life by demonstrating they have the proof of her virginity. If they don't, then that is considered evidence enough for her to be stoned to death. So apparently, in the parents' meets are two or more witnesses, because they were supposed to be the witnesses, not having, you know, the garment to prove it. are then very unhappily, but nonetheless, forced to testify, no, she's not a virgin. So we got two witnesses and she dies. 22 is a single verse on adultery. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman, thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. You know, I think I made a mistake earlier and I said this only went down to 22, but this whole section here on sexual sins goes to the end of the chapter. I'm second guessing myself. I'm not sure if I said that or not, but it should be all the way down to the end here. And I'm seeing my notes better as I turn the page. So adultery, of course, but you have to have the witnesses. Now, in 23, if there's a girl who is a virgin, engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. So she's guilty if she doesn't cry out in this passage. But the next one's in 25. So that was fornication with the betrothed. 25 says, if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged, and a man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. You shall do nothing to the girl. There is no sin in the girl worthy of death. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. When he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. Now again, brethren, you know, when you start meditating on these and imagining these scenarios, it's easy to come up with a lot of "but what if," you know, questions. And I can't answer them. I think no law, no single law, is likely ever going to be able to cover every case. So look at this one again. If in the field, why is the field mentioned, whereas before in 23 and 24 we had the city? What's the difference between the two other than the definition? What's the practical application difference between the two? Pardon me?
People in the city.
Sure, she cries out in the city, somebody will surely hear her. There's a high concentration of ears. But in the country, no. She has screamed louder than any ever has, and nobody's there to hear. But brethren, in 25, couldn't she also be willing? So now I could say, well, what if? You know, and then I don't have an answer here. What if she's lying about this thing? You know, and so she actually was willing right here. Well, if in the field the man finds the girl is engaged, the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. Well, what are you going to do if she's just lying? How are you going to know if she's lying? I don't have answers for that. In the practical application, you took the harder cases to higher levels of court. Finally, a priest or a judge, as we read a few weeks back, is going to make the final decision, and everybody has to abide by it. I don't believe those men were always inspired, and I don't believe even the most honest and fair of among them, you know, was always infallible. They probably made mistakes. It happens to this day. But I can't explain all the variations and the exceptions that we can imagine, nor do I think I have to. God is teaching about sexual purity. He is teaching that there's a death penalty attached to it. He is teaching these things. And then to the best of their ability, they're going to go ahead and try to apply these laws. I just don't know that absolutely every case is going to be covered, you know. And for instance, you know, we read this last week, I think it was. What do you do when you find a body and you don't know who killed it? Well, you're going to measure to the next city and a sacrifice is going to be made. Well, but maybe the guy that killed him wasn't even from that city. Well, no matter. It happened to be closer. So you're not really getting justice. You're not finding out who did it. So I don't think they were inspired, these judges. They were not able to find every murderer. They're not able to find every rapist either. I'm always able in most laws to dig down enough that I can imagine a scenario where it just becomes unanswerable. The skeptic is great at this. They're always coming up with some scenario that, you know, I can't answer. My ignorance on how to apply a given law to a specific case does not prove there is no God, does not prove that God is unjust or unfair, and does not, you know, make a strike against the veracity and the believability of Scripture. These become imponderables. Perry Mason probably solved all his cases, but I don't think anybody else ever has since him. So since the 60s, there just isn't an answer for everything. Now then, in verse 25, we just read that one, 27, just completed, we found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. Well, we're presuming she did, but maybe she didn't. Haven't you seen, what was in To Kill a Mockingbird? People lie sometimes for their own reasons. Well, I don't have an answer for it. 28 through 30, if a man finds a girl who is a virgin, who is not engaged, seizes her, lies with her, they are discovered, then the man who lay with her shall give the father's give the girl's father 50 shekels of silver. She shall become his wife because he's violated her, and he can't divorce her all his days. Now please note in this case, two chapters later, we'll have it next week, we studied it thoroughly on Sunday mornings. You know, we're going to be looking at Deuteronomy 24 here, you know, pretty soon. But while there is, in Moses' law, divorce and remarriage for fornication in Deuteronomy 24, we've just read two cases where Deuteronomy 24 may not be invoked. If you publicly shame and defame a virgin in Israel, and if you did this, where you find a girl as a virgin, not engaged, you seize her and lie with her, then you're going to marry her, and you can never divorce her, even if she becomes an adulteress. I'm guessing that when you add all these laws up, this sanctifies marriage, protects both men and women, is intended to keep it very, very sacrosanct, and the marriage bed, as Hebrews will say, undefiled. Okay, so Deuteronomy 24 allows a man whose heart has been hardened because his wife's adulteress, she's playing the harlot, certainly his heart's going to be hardened against her, he's allowed to divorce her and she can remarry in Deuteronomy 24. There's two exceptions to that over here. 23, who may and may not assemble is in 1 through 8. And this, for me, brethren, is a great conundrum. Once again tonight, I really don't know. I just don't know what to say about this. There's two ways to understand, at the end of verse 1, the assembly of the Lord. Even as ecclesia, called out, church, can be properly translated three different ways. It can refer to everybody who's ever been accepted by God from Adam to the last person before the judgment who comes to Christ, the church universal. It can refer to everybody in a given location who worships in a given congregation. Or it can refer to this assembly of people, a subset of the local congregation, which is a subset of the church universal. It can be used three ways. Assembly of the Lord here can be used at least two. Is it talking about not allowing these people to participate in what is sometimes called the convocations, the group gatherings? Or is it saying they must be banished from the Jewish society? And it's awful hard for me to tell, but I rather think it's the former and not the latter. When we're about to read this now, you keep this in mind. Is this saying that a person in this circumstance must be cast out from among the Jewish people? I don't think so. I think it's talking about assemblies. Bill?
Well, I was just going to bring that up and read down a couple of verses.
Let's just go ahead. So no one who is emasculated or who has his male organ cut off shall enter the assembly of the Lord. No one of the legitimate birth shall enter the assembly of Yahweh. Well, it's hardly their fault. None of his descendants, even in the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of Yahweh. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of Yahweh. None of their descendants, even in the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly. Well, does that mean they can't become proselytes? They were supposed to be put to death. I've got to be careful myself now. Ammonite and Moabite, I think, are on that list of seven. But it says that this curse is specific to these people now because of an action they took. So it's not racial. In verse 3, four, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you, back in Numbers. Nevertheless, Yahweh your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but Yahweh your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because Yahweh your God loves you. You shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. You shall not detest an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not detest an Egyptian, because you are an alien in his land. The sons of the third generation who are born to them may enter the assembly of Yahweh. Well, now I really get confused, because sometimes in this very passage of 8 verses, it sounds like we are talking about whether or not you can be a Jew at all. And then after a certain number of generations, you know, that goes away. It's got a statute of limitations. You know, it's been attached. So I'm just going to leave that one to you. I'm not sure if that term is to be used only one way in the passage, or even which way myself. They knew. We don't. We don't have to practice this law. There is no Jew and Gentile anymore. No Edomite or Moabite did anything to me. So it's not applicable today. Verse 9. Down through verse 14, I'm going to call army camp hygiene. When you go out as an army against your enemies, and you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. If there is among you any man who is unclean because of a nocturnal emission, then he must go outside the camp. He may not re-enter the camp. But it shall be when evening approaches, he shall bathe himself with water, and at sundown he may re-enter the camp. You shall also have a place outside the camp and go out there, and you shall have a spade among your tools. It shall be when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and shall turn to cover up your excrement. Since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy. He must not see anything indecent among you, lest he turn away from you. Okay, so it's just camp hygiene during war for the Jews. The escaped slaves in verses 15 and 16 is another head scratcher. You shall not hand over to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall live with you in your midst, in the place which he shall choose, in one of your towns where it pleases him. You shall not mistreat him. Now, I don't understand that. Again, some suggest, and I think with some reason, that we're not talking about Jewish slaves and Jewish masters. That's not the point. And it would be so unfair to the Jewish slave owner. We read in detail. Many of these slaves volunteered themselves because they'd accrued debts they couldn't pay back. It's not fair to the guy that you owe all this money to just stiff him and tell him tough. This was regulated. It had stipulations, a moment of freedom. You could willingly choose to be a slave for life if you wanted to. We've already been through all of that. And now to just throw all of that away and say, all you got to do is run and grab some guy on the street, and now he has to keep you and he can't go back, seems to me to just totally defeat everything God ever said about the laws of slavery. So I'm thinking maybe this one does have to do, you know, with a Jew-Gentile relationship rather than defrauding your brother by taking in a slave. You know, it just would be chaos. I don't know. But I'm sure they did. And they had the judges to straighten it out. 17 and 18. None of the daughters of Israel shall be a cult prostitute, nor shall any of the sons of Israel be a cult prostitute. There was also homosexual prostitution in the idolatry of the day, well known. You shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the wages of a dog into the house of Yahweh your God for any votive offering, for both of these are an abomination to Yahweh your God. There is some reason to believe that the term dog here is synonymous with male cult prostitute. And it would make sense that we'd have the male and the female then in both passages. But if not, then also don't know what the wages of a dog are. And so I can't help you with that one either. But cult prostitution, male or female, is forbidden. 19 and 20. Charging interest is well known to all of us. You shall not charge interest to your countrymen. Note, to your countrymen. You shall not charge interest to your countrymen. Interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest, so that Yahweh your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land which you are about to enter to possess. It doesn't need comment. Vows in the next three verses, and we'll be done after a few verses on gleaning. When you make a vow to Yahweh your God, it's perfectly legal to make a vow. You shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you. And Yahweh your God will surely require it of you. Now, brethren, that's exactly what you did when you made yourself a slave to one of your fellow Jews. You were making a vow that you would pay off your debt in service. Well, this passage says when you make a Lord a vow, you got to pay it. You can't just run away. So I'm thinking the other one just can't be Jew on Jew slavery, which was perfectly legal. It'd be a sin here in 21. Yahweh your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin in you. This is nothing new that Jesus added in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, make no vow at all. That's exactly what this verse says. Jesus was elaborating upon Moses' law in the Sermon on the Mount by paraphrasing this verse with regard to vows. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you voluntarily vowed to Yahweh your God what you promised. Now, gleaning completes the chapter. When you enter your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you are fully satisfied, but you shall not put any in your basket. When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. This is not legal theft. Gleaning is also elaborated upon. These are only for the very poor in the land who are unable to sustain themselves and or those that are traveling through the land and consequently can't carry enough food and don't have a way to get from point A to point B. So within the Jewish nation, some 150 miles of heavy population from north to south, you are allowed to glean, to stay alive, which is what Jesus and the apostles were doing when they were criticized for working on a Sabbath. The law said they could. The Pharisees were wrong. Jesus never argued with Moses. He argued with the Pharisees' misapplication and twisting. Jesus clarified law. He did not annul it. Okay? Class dismissed.